9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Well, Caesar was warned to beware the Ides of March. The day that many of us dread these days is the middle of April, not March. It's tax day. When it comes to the income tax, everyone has an opinion, which is the main reason we're doing this show. This hour, I'll have two different guests on the topic of taxes. In this first segment, I'll be joined by Len Berman, director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture between the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Then, after 8:30, my guest will be Robert McIntyre, director of the Center for Tax Justice. You can join in at any time by calling us at 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234, toll-free. In Madison, it's a local call for you, so we'd appreciate it if you'd use 263-1890, 263-1890. Emailers, here's your address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Len Berman joins me by telephone. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is the day that, I don't know how many of us really dread it anymore, but at least we say we do, and it makes nice conversation around the water cooler. God, I had to pay my taxes today. But the United States didn't have an income tax to begin with. When did this system get started?
Well, the current income tax was put in place in 1913. It actually required a constitutional amendment. An income tax had been tried in the late 1800s, and actually there was one during the Civil War as well, but there was a Supreme Court case that found that it was unconstitutional. Originally, the Constitution really had in mind the states collecting most of the tax revenues, and the federal government basically begging from the states for the revenues and resources it needed. I mean, in fact, the founders didn't even have in mind having a national army. They imagined a set of state militias. Obviously, the country had changed a lot. You know, in 1913, we were on the brink of World War One. Although I don't know if people knew that at the time. And then in 1943, income tax withholding was put in place. It's very familiar right now, but before 1943, you filed your income tax return at the end of the year and you sent money to the Treasury, and only a small percentage of people did that. It was very, very high income people. To finance World War II, the government needed a lot more revenues. And ironically, Milton Friedman, the famous conservative, was one of the people who came up with the idea of payroll tax withholding as an easy way for people to pay their income tax obligations and to make it possible to raise a lot more revenue. And he said later that that was a decision that he regretted pretty much for the rest of his life.
Well, clearly, people would be a lot more upset on April 15th if they had to write a check for the entire amount of the tax that they owed than with federal withholding. I've always suggested that in Wisconsin, that's probably one reason why people get more upset over the property tax than they probably should, because they have to come up with the whole thing as a lump sum.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing is that the income tax is pretty progressive. It doesn't take much from low and middle income households. The vast majority of the tax is paid by the top 10% of income earners. So that's an advantage of an income tax over, say, a sales tax or even a property tax, because the burden can be placed on those people who are most able to pay it. I mean, under the current tax, the income tax 87% comes from the top 20%, the richest 20%, and 72% comes from the top 10%.
When we say top 10%, what kinds of income are we talking about? What's the range there?
I don't actually have the numbers right in front of me, although I can check in a minute. It's probably around $100,000 and up for a family. So obviously it varies a lot by region. Somebody earning $100,000 in a big city is not going to be as rich as somebody earning $100,000 out in the country. That's actually one of the complaints about the way we measure the progressivity of the tax. Nonetheless, you know, most people don't have to pay very much under the income tax. Most people actually pay more in FICA taxes for Social Security and Medicare than they do for income tax.
Well, and if you're, let's say you have your income, household income is around $100,000. If you own a home, even with interest rates for home mortgages as low as they have been over the last 5 or 10 years, you probably have enough deductions to your tax liability is probably in the $12,000 to $14,000 range, depending on how much charitable giving you do and some other variables there. And so when you think about it, maybe if you compare that to all the other things that you spend money on, it's probably not the biggest item.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, has our tax system been more progressive at other times in our history than it is now?
Yeah. Most times over the last 30 years. The tax cuts enacted since 2001 have made the tax system less progressive, meaning that a larger share, that the taxes are a smaller share of income for high-income people than they are for those with middling, or than they used to be. The Bush tax cuts benefited, at least in the short run, people across most of the income distribution, but the largest benefits went to people earning over $200,000 a year. And one of the biggest benefits was cutting the capital gains tax rate from 20% to 15%. Most people don't actually have capital gains that are taxable under the income tax. The top income tax rate was cut from 39.6% to 35%. Now, when I say that, conservatives bristle and say, I'm some kind of a Scrooge, that in fact everybody got tax cuts, so why should I complain? The problem is that those tax cuts were paid for by borrowing. It's not like there was a pot of money sitting around in Washington waiting for the politicians to give it away to people, or it might have seemed like that in 2000 when there were big surpluses, but those disappeared immediately. We're borrowing that money from our children and grandchildren, and what we don't know is how we're going to pay those deficits back. From my perspective, a better policy is to pay our bills on an annual basis. If you think that government's too big, then cut spending. If you think that government is the right size and you need to raise taxes to pay for it. The problem is politicians, some of them say that, well, we're spending too much, but at the same time that they're cutting taxes, they've actually increased spending pretty dramatically, not just for the war and Homeland Security, but for the first 4 or 5 years of the Bush administration, discretionary spending, the just regular day-to-day expenses of the government, was actually growing faster than during the Clinton administration.
I'd like to try and clear up some historical mysteries here, if we can, and not ancient history, but I seem to recall that that at one time the interest on things like what we'd call now credit card debt, revolving installment loans, that kind of thing, borrowing for the purchase of a car, all of that interest used to be tax deductible, which was a major interest was a major deduction for many middle class families, and that disappeared. But I'm trying to remember when. I think it was in the early 1980s.
It was actually 1986. The Tax Reform Act of 1986 got rid of a lot of deductions and preference items in exchange for lowering tax rates overall. Before 1986, the top tax rate was 50%. It was cut to 28%. The argument for eliminating the deduction for consumer interest is that there was an incentive in the tax code to borrow because you could deduct the interest, and if you could borrow the money and say put it into something that paid capital gains that wasn't taxed very much, and that the economists worry that kind of an incentive basically creates. Just creates an avenue for tax sheltering. It's not very good for the economy. Also, as a nation, we just don't save very much. The personal savings rate is around 1% or possibly even less. And you don't want to have a tax system that's encouraging people to borrow and discouraging people from saving.
Of course, how did that work out? I mean, we borrowed and we're not saving anyway.
Yeah, that's actually been one of the great mysteries. Since 1980, there have been all sorts of incentives for people to save more. You can put more money in individual retirement accounts, 401ks, and so on than was true before that, and the savings rate has just stayed really, really low. What it suggests is that there might be some more fundamental changes that are needed. And the other thing is that it calls into question the conservatives' critique of the income tax as one that stifle savings and hampers economic growth. I mean, in fact, the economy grew has grown very well with high tax rates. It's grown very well with low tax rates. There are probably other factors that are more important.
Well, let's talk about another historical topic here, just to clear this up, the so-called marriage tax penalty. Wasn't this originally touted as a pro-family tax policy by people who wanted mom to stay home and raise the kids?
I'm not aware of that. I think it was more of an accident or more of a function of the fact that in 1913, there weren't too many two-earner couples that were paying income tax, so it wasn't really considered to be much of a problem. Basically, in our current tax system, which taxes households rather than individuals, it's impossible to be neutral to eliminate marriage penalties and also be fair to singles. After World War II, there was this movement. I don't remember this. I wish I could remember the name of the woman who was behind this, but it was someone started a group called War Widows of America, and she argued that the income tax system was unfair to single people because basically it provided too much and breaks for married couples, that marriage penalties were pretty small, virtually non-existent, and single people, say people who lost their husband in the war, ended up paying much higher tax than they would if they were married, and she argued that was really unfair. So in the 1950s, the tax system was sort of readjusted to be a little bit fairer with respect to singles. In the 1980s, 90s, and this decade, the concern's been more about eliminating marriage penalties, or reducing marriage penalties, reducing disincentives to marry, and that clearly has been a function of the fact that so many more two-earner couples are working. It's kind of a balancing act. But right now, most couples pay less tax than they would pay if they were single people being taxed under the single tax schedules.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we have some people who want to join us by phone. You could be one of them if you call 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, you can use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Feel free to join in the discussion. We're talking about taxes, and we'll be back to continue the discussion in just a moment. 22 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Here's what's coming up a bit later on the Ideas Network. Making marriage work is work, but it can be very fulfilling work. After 5 at issue, Ben Marins talks with the co-authors of Learning to Love, From Conflict to Lasting Harmony. That's after 5 o'clock today on At Issue with Ben Marins. This hour, it's taxes on our mind, and my guest in this segment is Len Berman. And he is the director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture between the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institutions. And then coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Robert McIntyre, who's director for Citizens for Tax Justice. We'll spend the whole hour talking about taxes with our two guests. And we have some people who want to join us by phone. Let's go first to Bill in Moscow. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm wondering if your guest knows about or is familiar with the Fair Tax Act that was described quite a bit by Mike Huckabee, and if he could talk about that a little bit, including some of the provisions for low income and maybe some of the benefits or problems if we went in that direction instead of the current system.
That's a great question. Fair taxes. A great example of successful marketing. Michael Gratz, who was an appointee in the first Bush administration, says that the one salient feature of the fair tax is that it isn't fair. It does take care of low-income people. Basically, what the fair tax is it's a national sales tax. It would be levied at a single rate on all sales across the country. The argument is that it could be administered by states because most of them already have sales taxes of their own. There are a couple problems with the sales tax. One is that the rate that's advertised, they say it's a 23% rate, wouldn't be anywhere near enough money to raise. To raise revenue to finance the government. The 23, because of some sleight of hand, a 23% rate is really a 30% rate. And President Bush's tax reform panel, which looked at the fair tax pretty closely, concluded that the rate would have to be a lot higher than that to raise enough revenue to finance the government. Another problem is that the fair tax, since it's collected at the point of sale, would stimulate a huge amount of tax evasion. If you have a 30 or 40 or 50% sales tax, there'd be a huge incentive to make your consumer sales under the table. It would generate a whole new underground economy, and compliance would be a big problem. There are other versions of consumption tax that are easier to collect. The value-added tax, which is common in the rest of the world, is collected at each stage of production. The other problem with the consumption tax is that it can't be as progressive as the income tax, because high-income people only spend a fraction of their income. So basically, you'd be, for very, very high-income people, you'd be exempting 50% or more of their income from tax because they don't spend it. The fair tax tries to deal with this by paying out this thing called a prebate. It would be a monthly payment to all households in America that's supposed to offset the amount of tax you'd owe if you were earning poverty-level income. President Bush's tax reform panel objected to that because they said that it would create the largest welfare program in history. But the other thing is, if you think about it, if low-income people aren't paying higher taxes and high-income people are getting a huge tax cut and we're raising enough revenue to finance the government, somebody's going to get stuck holding the bag, and it has to be middle-income people. And that's probably the biggest defect in the fair tax. So the other thing is that they would like to have a constitutional amendment to eliminate the income tax and make sure it never comes back again. And to say the least, that would be a big challenge. A lot of conservatives who think the idea of moving away from taxing income to taxing spending is a good idea object to the fair tax because they think it couldn't work politically and practically.
You write that the income tax system that we have now has some flaws, but it's better than any of the alternatives that have been proposed. What are some of the other alternatives that people have been looking at? I keep waiting in this campaign for the flat tax to come back.
Yeah. So the fair tax was one of the alternatives, and I think the fair tax would just be a disaster. It wouldn't raise anywhere near enough money to finance the government. It would eviscerate state finances, because when people cheated to avoid the federal tax, they'd also be avoiding state taxes, and states wouldn't be able to administer an income tax either. The flat tax is actually another bit of great mislabeling. It sort of sounds like an income tax, but it's really a consumption tax in drag, where the wage portion of the tax is paid by workers. Again, they try to take care of people with low incomes, but the burden of the tax would get shifted from those who are very well off to people with relatively moderate incomes. Senator Thompson proposed an alternative tax system where you could figure out your taxes under this alternative simple baseline and pay that if you wanted to. And Thompson's plan actually wouldn't make things much simpler, because you'd have to figure out your taxes, you know, yet one more way to figure out what you owed. It would also reduce federal tax revenues by something like $6 or $7 trillion over the next 10 years. And one of the basic functions of government is to pay its bills, and a lot of these proposals wouldn't do that. Senator McCain has proposed extending all the tax cuts that are expiring at the end of 2010, and a big cut in corporate taxes. Again, that would generate that would create big financial problems for the government, which, unless there were draconian cuts in spending, would mean that our kids would end up with enormous debt burdens, and it wouldn't be as progressive as the current tax system. The people at the very top of the income distribution, really, really high earners, have done tremendously well over the last 20 or 30 years. They're the ones who are benefiting from globalization, from information technology, and all that. Most of the rest of the population has had very, very small income gains or none at all. And it seems only fair that the burden of tax should be placed on the people who are most able to pay it, people with, you know, incomes over $100,000, $200,000 or even more.
Let's take another caller. We've got, let's see here, Tony is on a cell phone. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My wife and I have been filing a joint return forever, and we've run into issues sometimes, and through procrastination or whatever, we end up coming up against the deadline, but we always have enough withheld out of our paychecks to we're pretty much guaranteed we're going to get a return from the government, foolish as that may be or not. The question I have is, I called the IRS. We ran up against the deadline three, four years ago, and I talked to somebody at the IRS, and they seemed to indicate that if we were guaranteed a return, we did not have to file a tax return, or I should say a refund. Is that true or not?
Okay, one caveat to start is I'm not a tax lawyer.
Okay.
Although Bob McIntyre is going to be on next, actually is. I mean, under most circumstances, I believe that that's true. I think there's some special circumstances under which you're required to file anyway. But if you're owed a refund, you can procrastinate, but it doesn't make much sense if you can avoid it, because you're basically giving an interest-free loan to the government while you're waiting to get your money back.
Yeah, I understand. It's just one of those things where, you know, you have a kid and
yeah, no, I understand. I actually hate doing the income taxes myself, and I did mine late at night yesterday.
Exactly.
Well, Tony, hang in there, because we've got Bob McIntyre coming up next, and I think he's listening now, so he can maybe give a more definitive answer to your question, because he is a tax lawyer. So,
well, great. Thank you so much.
Hang in there. Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. Appreciate it. Len Berman, before we let you go here, give us we talked about Senator McCain's tax proposals, and he's going to be making a major speech about taxes here in the next day or two. And what about the two Democrats, Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, the tax proposals that they've made? What do you think of those?
Well, they're somewhat less fiscally reckless than Senator McCain's, but one of the things that's been frustrating over the last 4 years, at least, is that at the same time that the Democrats have criticized President Bush for not raising enough revenue to pay our bills, basically they've bought into his revenue, to his baseline. They would extend all the middle class tax cuts, which are supposed to expire at the end of 2010, and they would pass. They favor a bunch of other tax cuts that would aid middle class families, which is fine, but we actually need to raise enough revenue to pay for the government. It's the problem is that, you know, our political system has gotten to be such where politicians think they can only be elected if they promise to give away things. Like, maybe that's always been true, but it seems worse now than it has been before. So there's a competition as to who can provide the most government services and cut taxes by the most. And you know, if you have children and you're worried about our long-term fiscal problems, and our long-term fiscal situation looks very, very dicey, because the baby boomers are retiring, healthcare costs are growing much faster than the economy. Projections for our national debt are that it's just going to balloon over time unless we change policies. And if you're worried about that, you need to come up with a fiscal system where you can actually raise enough revenues to pay for the government. The other thing is that the Democrats and the Republicans alike love all of these so-called tax expenditures or subsidy programs run through the tax system. Senator Obama would provide a new tax subsidy for working, which might be a good idea, except he's not paying for it, as far as I can tell. And he would exempt most old people from tax. I mean, actually, most of them don't pay tax now, but he would raise the exemption level up to about $50,000. And both Obama and Clinton would have tax credits for education and for health care and for various other things. They make the tax system more complicated. They add to the perception a lot of people have the tax system just isn't fair, because it's so incomprehensible that people think they must not be getting their fair share, and I think that's a problem. I think people should understand the tax system. I think its primary role ought to be to raise enough revenues to finance the government in a fair way. There are a few things you can do well through the tax system, like there's an earned income tax credit that encourages low-income people to work and raises their incomes. But a lot of things we do through the tax system are needlessly complicated and probably don't even work all that well in terms of advancing their objectives.
Len Berman, thank you so much for spending this half hour with us. Appreciated your insights on the tax system. And mention your website before we go.
Oh, taxpolicycenter.org. And the article you're talking about is on our blog, which is called TaxVox, TaxVox.org. And thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Len Berman, director of Tax Policy Center, a joint venture between the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institutions. Well, our program about taxes continues here on the Ideas Network. Here are the numbers for you to join in the discussion. It's 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's a local call for you, 263-1890, 263-1890. My guest in this segment of the program is Robert McIntyre, who is Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, and on the web you can find them at www.ctj.org. Robert McIntyre joins me by phone. Good morning, and thank you for being with us.
Good morning to you.
Well, I don't know how much of the conversation you could hear. There was one of our callers had a question regarding tax law, and Len Berman, who was my guest in the first part of the program, wanted to defer to you on it. If you are getting a refund and you know you're getting a refund, is the April 15th deadline a real deadline?
No, you can file late. You still have to file, but you can file late, and the penalty doesn't exist if you don't owe taxes.
There's a lot of mis and disinformation floating around out in the media and the blogosphere about who pays what in taxes and which tax system would work best and so forth. In your opinion, what's the worst piece of misinformation floating around out there about our tax system in the United States?
Well, of course, I'm not misinformed myself, so...
Well, that's
I may not know.
We're making that assumption to begin with.
There's sort of two ends, and it generally involves wealthy people. I don't mean that they're misinformed, but half of the public believes that rich people don't pay any taxes at all, and the other half thinks that, based on propaganda from some of the conservative groups, that the rich pay all the taxes.
Well, neither one of those two things is true, so what is, in fact, the truth about who pays what in taxes?
Well, when you add up all the taxes that are imposed in this country, you know, the federal income tax, the payroll taxes, the gasoline taxes, the property taxes, and so forth, it turns out that our system is very modestly progressive. Very low-income people pay a lower share of their income in taxes than everybody else. But middle-income people, all the way up to the richest people, in general, pay just about the same share of their income in taxes, no matter how much they make. So it's almost flat, a little teeny bit progressive, moving up from the middle to the upper middle, and then at the very high end, it falls off just a hair.
We have some callers who want to join us, and we just lost somebody. Let's go to Dan in White Lake. Dan, good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For calling.
I'm going to get on a different phone here.
Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. Thanks, Dan.
I've been doing income taxes for 50 years, and I just finished a bunch. I no longer do them for anybody except a few close relatives and friends, and I can tell you, going back in the 60s, when we had a 70% tax bracket, it produced all kinds of tax dodges. And fellas, a particular individual whose income tax returns I used to do back then, and who was a plastic surgeon making between $300,000 and $400,000, completely eliminated his federal income tax by buying investments in railroad rolling stock. And it's way too complicated to explain, but the fellas that were selling the investments were making $2,000 or $3,000 a day selling them. And I think that, first of all, at the end of the Clinton administration, we had a surplus. We probably need, in order to make things more fair and eliminate the situation that your caller just mentioned, that half the people think that the rich don't pay any taxes, and then some people think that the rich pay all the taxes. We need more brackets, And the reason I say that is because, on the one hand, my son, for example, who pays his Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid from his very first dollar because he only earns about $35,000 a year, when he also, because he's single, he's in the highest tax bracket that he could be in, he ends up paying what amounts to 35% of his income in taxes of one kind or another. Whereas somebody who earns $300,000 or $400,000 a year and has his Social Security cut off at, I believe nowadays it's about $98,000, when you and if he has a reasonable amount of itemized deductions, he's quite likely to be paying less than 20% of his income in taxes. If we adjusted things so that there's such an income disparity in this country, it was even reported not too long ago that 25 hedge fund managers who get their income mostly in the form of capital gains, if they had been taxed at ordinary income rates, they would have paid into the government an additional $2 billion with a B, which works out to $40 million apiece on average. When some people have incomes like that, you know, how could you possibly spend $40 million a year? I say no man can possibly need that. And that's why I think we need more brackets, and we need to take more from the very wealthy, and this is how we can support the middle class. The middle class is supposed to be a buffer between the poor, who, if they ran things, would have us in a welfare state, and the ultra-rich, who, if they ran things, would be our aristocracy. And I'll listen to what you have to say off the air.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dan. Appreciate it. Bob McIntyre, care to respond to that?
Well, I think he's right that the tax system has lost much of its progressivity, particularly in recent years. You know, you had the Reagan tax cuts that back in the 80s that lowered taxes on the wealthy, and Bill Clinton recaptured some of that, but then George W. Bush went in the opposite direction. And if you look at the arithmetic, when you're all done, you see that the people at the very top ended up with very large tax cuts. Middle-income people got small ones, and everything was done on borrowed money, so most of us are worse off than we were before Bush got started. So we'd be better off with a balanced budget and asking those who make way too much money to chip in more to support the country that's made it possible for them to be so wealthy.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls and questions about taxes and your opinion about what we might want to do to the tax system, or questions you have about how it operates. My guest is Robert McIntyre, Director of Citizens for Tax Justice. You can join us by phone at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890 if you're in the Madison area. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll be back and talk some more about taxes in just a moment. It's 844. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, next hour, after 9, Jim Packard talks with a national security expert about the latest news from Iraq. And by the way, Kathleen Dunn will be back tomorrow. So, Kathleen Dunn fans, you get her back tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Today, though, Jim Packard is in for Kathleen, and he'll have a national security expert on after 9 talking about the latest news from Iraq. That's what's coming up on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about taxes. And in this segment of the program, my guest is Robert McIntyre, who's Director of Citizens for Tax Justice. We had a, Christopher sends us a message. He says that if taxes are too high, the problem is the size of government, and we should shrink it so we don't have to pay for it. That's a fairly common sentiment, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, we certainly would need less taxes if we shrunk the government. Of course, you have to decide where you want to shrink it, and most of the...
Well, there's the rub, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at where the government spends its money, and some people would say, well, there's too much going to defense, cut that. Others would say, well, there's not enough going to defense, but we really spend way too much on Social Security, we should cut that. And that's a debate we have in a democracy. The spending right now... is high largely because of the war in Iraq. Other programs are about where they've been for many, many decades. So it's apparently we're at our comfort level with the possible exception of defense.
Well, you hit a point earlier that I wanted you to amplify, and that is that the tax cuts and the spending that are both occurring now are being pretty much paid for by borrowed money. I read, I'm trying to remember where I saw this. It was an article in one of the papers I read looking at this, that right now Washington will spend $25,117 per household in 2008. But let's see, only about 20 or 22,000 of that is actually covered by tax revenue, and the rest of it is all borrowed. And sooner or later, those bonds that the Chinese government and others are holding are going to have to come due and be paid for. And what's going to happen then?
Well, what has to happen, and I think everybody understands this who can do arithmetic, is that either taxes have to be higher or programs have to be cut way back, and neither one's a happy solution. And when that does happen, you know, it's going to be politically very difficult, because what you'll be telling the voters is, okay, the time has come when we have to start paying for spending, okay, people say. And by the way, we have to pay for the spending that we did 10 years ago. And people don't say okay, because that's no fun at all when you have to pay back for programs that you got a long time ago because, you know, you're not getting them now. So it's going to be whoever's elected president is going to have to address this, and it's going to be a very difficult period.
Let's take a call next from John in Milwaukee. John, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I had a comment on the fair tax and then also a suggestion for taxing in the future. My comment on the fair tax is that actually it's a punishment for baby boomers who have saved money, in the sense that if I worked all my life and I earned money, I paid income tax on that earned money and I saved it and invested it. And now if all of a sudden you put a 25% value added or sales tax on and lower the income tax, then what happens is when I spend the money that I saved, I'm getting taxed doubly on it, because I was taxed in income tax when I earned that money on a capital gains if I invested it. And now you're going to tax it again, and it would be a windfall for the government, but it also would be unfair to baby boomers who were saving money all their life. And then my suggestion tax-wise to make it fair is, the way I look at the Defense Department is I look at the Defense Department very similar to homeowners insurance, in the sense that the Defense Department is a way to protect my assets, just like homeowners insurance is a way to protect my assets. So if I buy homeowners insurance and I have a bigger home, I pay more for my homeowners insurance. What I would suggest is we separate out the Defense Department and we look at all the assets, just major assets. If you look at money in the bank, if you look at stocks and bonds, if you look at real estate ownings within and property ownings, we can evaluate how many assets there are in the U.S., major assets. And then you look at the Defense Department and you set up a percentage, so that if you own X percent of the total assets in the United States, you pay X percent of the Defense Department because you have a bigger home. And it's no different than homeowners insurance. If you have a bigger home, you pay more for homeowners insurance because you have that bigger home. If you have more assets of the United States and you expect the Defense Department to defend that and to protect those assets, you should pay percentage-wise more based on the assets that you own. And people who are poor, who don't have assets, really wouldn't be paying for the Defense Department. But I think it would be a fairer way to tax for the Defense Department, because it is just a big homeowner's insurance policy.
Thanks for that, John. Bob McIntyre, response?
Well, I think he's on to something, if not technically, at least the spirit of it. You know, for the last 8 years, we've been taking the Social Security surplus and devoting it to the Defense Department rather than saving it for the future. And that's a tax that you stop paying at about $100,000 of earnings. So people who have the most to defend don't have to pay for it. And it's just the opposite of what the caller was talking about. And it's really immoral, I think, that this practice has been going on.
Let's take a call next from Sandy in Algoma. Sandy, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think I'm probably pretty confused, because I looked at the Grace Commission study that was done by Reagan in the 1980s, And it showed that our taxes don't actually pay for any of the government services that we normally expect the government to provide, that instead our taxes actually paid for the interest that was charged by the Federal Reserve to print our money, and that, in fact, all the other things that our government provides is paid for by, like, other direct taxes, like the gas tax and the road tax and the license tax, that the military is actually funded by corporate income taxes, and it comes out to be, when we're not at war, it comes out to be almost exactly the right amount. So maybe you can explain that to me so that I understand it better, because apparently I'm misinformed.
Thanks for the call, Sandy.
Sure.
So, well, the personal income tax is the government's biggest tax, and it pays for more of the government than anything else. The corporate income tax is much smaller and doesn't come close to funding the Defense Department, even if it were dedicated. Of course, Social Security is funded by its payroll tax, and we do fund roads, which is a relatively small item in the budget, with gasoline taxes. But the biggest item is personal income tax. The second biggest item, sadly, is borrowing money and putting off paying for it until the future.
We're talking with Robert McIntyre, Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, and we have open phone lines for you right now at 800-642-1234 and 263-1890. Let's take a call from Christopher in the Twin Cities area. Christopher, good morning.
Good morning. When I mentioned earlier about the shrinking of the government, what I was talking about was in the salary of the people doing the jobs. What we need to do is get some of these large baby boomer population that we have and some of the elderly people that we have that have skills and put them into working for the government, you know, and not in volunteer work.
So they'd work for free?
Why not? They're getting to a point where we need the openings and jobs and stuff like that in our society, or take a tax credit and a reduced salary for it.
The thing about
working for the government, and most people forget, is that it's supposed to be a privilege to work for the government. And they go, well, we don't get the biggest and brightest people. Well, if you're bright and you're one of the best people, then you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. I mean, look at what we pay senators and House of Representatives, and it starts to get ridiculous in comparison to what the average person makes.
Okay, thanks for that, Christopher. So we should have our senior citizens working for free for the government.
Good luck.
Yeah, I would say good luck with that. Let's go next to Tom in Eau Claire. Tom, go ahead.
Hello, it's nice to listen to your show. Very informative. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I'm filling out my tax forms as we speak. And I made use of the electronic filing system earlier when I went to the IRS website. They directed me to a handful of third-party websites, which are maintained and operated by independent companies. Those companies immediately ask you for your Social Security number and create a file on you in which they collect your personal information in order to file for you. I immediately closed my computer and disconnected it from the Internet because that seems to me very sensitive information that's now being placed into the hands of basically data mining organizations. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think it's an outrage that the IRS does not provide free filing electronically online for most people. It does for low incomes, but for most people it doesn't. And if we're going to have to pay our taxes, and certainly we do, why don't they make it easy to do it with a program online that, you know, is protected by the government security system and not send it out to private parties? Well, we know the answer why they don't do it. Lobbying by the tax preparers and the TurboTax manufacturers and so forth had made Congress prohibit the IRS from doing what it ought to be doing, and I think people ought to just start complaining about it. You know, every state in the union that I've ever filed a tax return in, and it's a lot, lets you file online through the state system. Why can't the federal government do the same thing?
Well, and if you want to pay, if you owe taxes and you want to pay by credit card, you can't do that directly through the IRS. You have to go to a third party. And I found that a little off-putting myself. We have an email from Tom in Wausau that I think we should get to here. Tom says, I think most, if not all, of today's cynicism would be removed if there was a truly simple tax system. What would be wrong with four or five brackets and no deductions for individuals and closure of all corporate loopholes and subsidies?
Well, I'm basically in favor of that. Obviously, he would include exemptions at the bottom to make sure we don't overtax the poor. He might even include some of the low-income tax credits. But after that, you know, if we had a simple system, people would moan, well, I don't get my mortgage interest deduction, and they'd have a case to make. So we'd probably have to phase that out gradually. But Britain just did it over a 20-year period, and they still have houses. They still have houses in Canada, even though they don't have a mortgage interest deduction. I think the only downside is the colorful roofs. But a simpler system that people could understand. We got into the ballpark of having such a system in the second half of the 1980s, and it lasted for about 10 years. And then management changed in the Congress, and then management changed in the White House, and now we have a system so complicated that nobody can understand it again, and that's too bad.
We're down to the last minute and a half or so of the program. If you could quickly give me your take on the tax proposals made by the various presidential candidates as we close here.
Well, John McCain is the easiest. He says he wants to extend all the Bush tax cuts, cut the corporate income tax by a third, and pay for it by cutting Social Security benefits by about a quarter or so. That's easy to follow, at least. But Democrats are more complicated. They want to extend some of the Bush tax cuts at a very great expense, not as much as McCain, but, you know, $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion over 10 years. They say they're going to find a way to pay for it, but they don't have enough things on the list yet, so that is a work in progress.
Anything, any simple solutions that you want to offer for our current tax dilemma, the complex system, make it simple and get rid of all the deductions is what you're proposing. Is that correct?
Or at least most of them. If you had asked me for a practical goal, something like we came up with after 1986, but with rates high enough to pay for the cost of whatever government we want.
That's really the key, isn't it? Making sure we've got enough income to cover the expenditures. Thank you so much for joining us today, Robert McIntyre. Appreciate your participation.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Robert McIntyre is director of the Center for Tax Justice, and their website is www.ctj.org. This program was produced by Karen Prager with on-air production by Christina Taylor. And thank you for joining us this morning. It's been a pleasure to spend the 3 hours with you. Coming up after the news, Jim Packard is in. By the way, if you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program number 415C, as in cash, which I don't think the IRS takes. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 5% appear too small.